Hey folks, thanks for being a member of the Cafe Insider community. In addition to the Cafe Insider podcast and my weekly note, you also get bonus material from my interviews on Stay Tuned with Preet. This is exclusively for you. Hope you enjoy it. Can you tell the story? Because I love it. You know, some people think it's all about the food, and you make clear, and this is the part of the book that's about entrepreneurship, there's so many other things you have to deal with. You have to understand what the local regulations are. You have to understand what the laws are. You have to be able to negotiate rent. You got to pass health inspections. And there came a time when you were kind of at wit's end, and you know, the whole business was riding on getting a positive health inspection. And you bet everything on a single faucet. Mm-hmm. Can you tell that story? Because I found that to be out of control.
And that was the funny thing writing this book, because there's a lot of stories like this, and you have to choose like one or two. So after the first two restaurants, and again, we almost went out of business many times, and we were levered as much as you could be financially, we finally sort of escaped death, and we're now profitable. And if we failed, my dad would have lost his business, and it was a nightmare scenario. We were having water issues because we were super busy. Our first restaurant, Momofuku Noodle Bar, was 600 square feet, and we were doing 250 to 350 people a day out of 27 seats, regardless of the weekend or weekday. It was totally bonkers. And because of our location, we didn't have access to the water heaters. That was to the coffee shop next door. So because of regulations, we couldn't upgrade it to a gas water stove. And that's important because you need hot water to cook and to wash dishes. So we knew we couldn't do that. We couldn't change it to a bigger electrical water stove because Con Ed didn't give us enough electricity with a certain amount of wattage per sort of store on that block. And what we were sort of, our size determined that we were allotted a certain chunk of electricity, basically. And we were always running out, even before we got busy. So we would always have to play these games of, hey, if I turn on that blender, we got to turn off the air condition. If we turn on this, we got to turn off that. It was always like having an estimation of how much wattage we were using, because things, circuits would blow. And it was, again, a nightmare. And it was something that you would see in like a comical TV show. So, you know, setting that up, we just averted death of operating our restaurants. And then I feel like we can breathe. And then one day the health department comes in, as they do with every restaurant, and they check the water temperature. And they were like, this is cold. And up until that point, I don't want to say that we weren't being safe, because I couldn't buy a fancy electric water heater. I bought a very expensive dishwasher that could do low temp dishes with different chemicals and solvents. And we were totally above all health regulations. But we didn't have the hot water for everything. So that's a critical violation. And a critical violation by the health department means if you don't fix it within 7 days, you're going to close. Now, I needed the revenue from that one restaurant to generate, to help us carry over the third restaurant that we were building. Because we knew that Noodle Bar was lacking hot water, we had actually decided to move it five stores up the block on 10th Street. So we were doing that, but I still needed that revenue to make ends meet. So if that didn't happen, we were going to lose all three restaurants. That was the unfortunate scenario. So basically, I was like, oh my God, we just averted death and now we're going to die again for sure.
And then you knew that a health inspector was going to come at some point and test a faucet. And obviously in a restaurant, you have multiple faucets. And you decided to do what?
Well, we had only one scenario. It was either, you know, close, or I hired a plumber late at night to divert every pipe of hot water. We had four sinks there to one sink. And we don't know when they're going to come in. We have no idea. So you do what you do. And I chose one sink, and he chose that one sink, and we had plenty of hot water, and we passed. And thankfully, we fixed everything after the fact, but...
Hold on a second. Just so we're clear. You had four sinks. The health inspector could have tested any one of them.
Yeah.
You made a wager in your mind that the health inspector would check that one sink, and in anticipation of that, you directed all the hot water to that one sink. And knowing that if you guessed wrong, and the inspector went to another sink, you were sunk, so to speak.
No, that was exactly the scenario. I mean, everything
would you do that again?
Unfortunately, I would have to, because there was no other choice, Preet.
Because you think there was not enough just to even pass unless you did that.
Yeah, there was no other choice. And as insane as it was, I would unfortunately have to do that again because it was the right decision.
So going back to my philosophical question, luck, because the inspector picked that sink, or merit, because you were smart enough to come up with the idea of diverting everything to the one sink?
I've been lucky as hell. It's so much luck, less merit. That's what I really believe.
I want to ask you about something that we have talked about, I know you care about, that goes beyond restaurants, but goes to how we feed people in this country and around the world, and how it can be, it's a question that gets asked often, how it can be that we have people who are going hungry or are starving or food insecure when we're the richest country on earth. How can that be, and what do we do about that?
I think it starts with education. Just like a quick story about that. I remember giving away turkeys or chickens to a food bank in New York. And it was like organic chicken. I did a demo. And if you were a family of four and under, you got a chicken for Thanksgiving. If you had more than four, you got a turkey. And I was espousing the virtues of organic this and organic that. And then a woman in line who only had three kids got a chicken, and she was pissed. She's like, I want a turkey. And she basically said, I'm going to curse. She's like, fuck you and your organic bullshit. And I was like taken aback, and I never forgot that day, because I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? Just the slow food movement is beautiful in theory, but it's not very practical. There's nothing pragmatic about our food system. And whenever I say my restaurants or the people that I work with feed a lot of people, we feed nobody. We don't. We feed a very select few of people. And our goal is, of course, we want everyone to eat well. And that's the thing. Everybody wants to eat well. Nobody wants to say they want to eat poorly. And it's unfortunate that we just don't have means to do that. And having lived abroad, you can see that in the food culture. I judge food cultures by one thing, and it sounds crazy, by the quality of their convenience stores, right? Because Japan has unbelievable convenience stores, and it's not a surprise that the food culture is so good.
You actually say about Japan in the book, because you spend time there, you could be poor, but could still eat like a king.
Yes. You can still eat well in other countries if you're not rich. If you're poor, you can still eat well. Like, I lived in a homeless shelter in Japan. Like, I'm telling you from my own experience, I know you can eat well with nothing, literally. And in America, that's not the case. And it's a sad reality. And, you know, I don't know where to begin, right? The people that need to eat the best in our country eat the worst. We're talking about the elderly and the young and hospital food. It doesn't have to be that bad. We're talking all this nonsense, not nonsense, all of this marketing about food as medicine. Well, that's only for people that are rich, you know, and we need to really think about this more holistically. And our school system's a nightmare. Our education about how we serve food, right? Going back to that chicken turkey story, we really need to think about how we give food and how we make it accessible and where our values are at. Because when I talk about education, I think it's still the stat is like over 50% of all food that gets produced in this world gets thrown away. So we need to learn about frugality and stretching things and
maximizing.
Over 50%.
In America, is it considerably more than other countries?
It's probably higher. Think about all the food you throw away. And that's another thing. You think about restaurants. Like, I question restaurants. Like, I got to make this duck breast and I got to square it up. So I'm going to slice the ends off and make it perfect to make it beautiful on the plate. Yes. But think about the stupidity. I'm cutting off food, throwing it away, or putting in a bucket for family meal. You know, people always say, oh, I don't throw anything away. And I was like, no, actually restaurants throw away food all the time. So you got to question how important it is. What kind of food do we want to serve? And again, like, if you really want to understand the ills of our food system, think about how we feed people that need are on food stamps and the elementary school system. It is a nightmare. And if we can't do that right, then I don't know what else we're really thinking about. So we need to get those things right first. And restaurants, as we've seen, are important, but not that important ultimately to how we function as a society.
What's the difference between a cook and a chef?
Best way I could describe it, if you're in the financial service industry, a cook is an analyst, a chef is your managing director. If you're a sports fan, a cook is a player, and you have a variety of players. You have bench players and superstars, and the chef is the coach slash GM.
In order to become a chef, do you need to have been an excellent cook?
No, and I'm proof in that you don't have to be that. And in fact, I'd argue if you're too good at cooking, it means you're not going to be a very good chef.
Why is that?
Because you've never learned to struggle. And being a chef means being a leader of people, literally means boss. And not everyone's going to be cut from the same cloth. They're going to have different aptitudes and different skills. And you're going to have to learn to empathize and to tailor your message to each and every person. And if you've only excelled at being a cook, you've never learned how not to be a good cook. And more often than not, as a chef, you're going to have to lead people that are going to be inferior cooks to you, you know, and so you're going to have to, empathy is such an important skill in all walks of life, but particularly being a chef, because you need to learn how people will taste your food and also how people are going to cook your food. So what's the point of making a very complicated recipe if no one else knows how to do it? So you have to learn to talk to people that aren't as good as you. And I find that people that are really, really good cooks don't know how to communicate that skill.
Is the customer always right?
Customer is almost never right.
That's why I asked you that question.
I mean, sometimes, you know, but I don't know where that platitude really came from.
But as a principle, does the restaurateur, the chef, the management accede to the wishes of the customer if the customer complains?
To a point, yes.
Otherwise, you kick the customer out?
Yes. When I was younger and dumber and less mature, we would obnoxiously almost antagonize the customer.
I know, because I read the book.
And now I'm like, oh my God, what was I doing? But you want to, now it's basically this. The customer is always right until they do something that is morally wrong, ethically wrong. And then that's when it's just like, you got to get out, never come back.
What is the best cuisine, and is it not Indian?
I will say that I know not enough about Indian food to proclaim it's the best, but I will tell you this.
I'm kidding, obviously.
I will tell you the truth. I think it is the most dominant cuisine in the world. I really believe that. And a lot of that we explored in Ugly Delicious, Don't Call It a Curry episode. And you are now a burgeoning food TV star since you are on Padma's Taste the Nation show.
I was. We had dosas in Washington Square Park.
So I really think that if you look at the influence that Indian food has around the world, I can't find a cuisine that has had that same impact. And when you look at spices specifically, you know, the world is a much less delicious, diverse place without the food of India. And so much of the complexity of Indian food is why it will never become sort of mainstream like McDonald's could ever be. And that's a beautiful thing.
Do you still golf?
I do not. I played one round of golf in 23 years. And that was last year. And I did that because I finally relented to my friend who asked me to play in his member guest tournament. I get asked to play in member guest tournaments a lot. But I don't think people realize how bad I am at golf now. So no, I'm just too competitive. And when I play golf, I become the worst version of myself.
Boy.
Yeah.
What's your favorite movie about food or restaurants?
There are some good ones and some bad ones. I always like Big Night. Because I think
I was hoping you would say Big Night, because that's mine.
It's such a good movie, and the ending is so accurate. Right? Again, summarizing the absurd stupidity of restaurants, I'm going to bet everything on the line for a meal that probably won't do anything for us. Right? That's in a nutshell the restaurant industry, and it's a beautiful story. I personally now connect with Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, Ang Lee's amazing film about a Taipei chef and his three daughters. Now I'm a parent because, again, at least in Asian culture, I feel like it is sort of synonymous. Like people don't emote love through words. It's oftentimes through food. And I get that movie a lot more than I ever did pre being a parent. So, but ultimately, I still think the best food about cooking is a damn cartoon, Ratatouille.
Oh, right. That was very good. Are there any foods that are, in fact, aphrodisiacs?
I don't know. I think sushi has become one of those things.
But is there science behind that, or is that just nonsense?
Maybe there's science, but so much of food science, I mean, it's just mumbo jumbo. I think it's mumbo jumbo.
Thank you again for becoming a member of Cafe Insider. Listen to the Cafe Insider podcast every Tuesday with Ann Milgram and me, and stay tuned every Thursday.